The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @newstalkscience. As we'll find out this week, you can handwrite a letter to us. We're at Marconi House, Diggs Lane in Dublin 2. Right, coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about the bit of magic that happens between a caterpillar and a butterfly. We all know from school and from the Very Hungry Caterpillar that a caterpillar eats a bunch of stuff and then builds a cocoon around itself, and then lo and behold, out comes a butterfly. But did you notice how we didn't hear what happened inside the cocoon? Well, new imaging techniques have lifted the lid on the amazing magic of metamorphosis, and we'll hear all about it on this week's episode. First, though, we're going to look back at the week's news stories, and joining me via the magic of the internet are Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher, both from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Oh, it's a boy. And what a boy!
That's the umbilical cord. It's a girl.
Is to do with a planet being born, Shane.
Yeah, this is a study from the Very Large Telescope, which is in Chile, and the Paris Observatory. And they've discovered, by taking a series of super cool photographs,
Technical term for them?
Yes, that's actually the scientific way we label them, super cool, you know. Well, you know, when you think that the thing is called the Very Large Telescope, I think, you know, anything goes really in terms of naming. But they have taken photographs of a planet that's being formed in a rather young solar system that's a mere 520 light years away from the Earth. So it's close, but not very close. And this is a newish star, so surrounding it a sort of a plane of dust. And they're looking at how these dust clouds are forming into what they think is a planet. And so when any solar system is formed, there's lots of dust that circles the star in the center. And we don't really know how exactly that dust starts to gravitate towards other bits of dust and form planets. Like, why do they happen in certain positions? Why are they a certain size? Why are some rocky, some are gaseous, etc.? So what they have done here is taken a series of photographs, and they're able to show that there's a certain sort of spiral twist coming out from the star. And within that spiral twist, they see a blob, a brighter blob, and they reckon that's where the planet is forming. And of course, being good physicists, they haven't just looked at this image and started to make up a theory. There had been work done on paper by theoretical physicists already that had predicted that a planet might form in this way. And so the observations are matching the prediction. So it's the classic case of the observation experiment confirming an idea that somebody had already.
But doesn't a planet form in the same way a star forms, in the same way anything that's solid out there in the universe forms, by stuff clumping together because of gravity?
It does, but so gravity is the underlying force that pulls things together. But why is Earth where the Earth is? Why is it not a little bit further out or a little bit closer to the sun? Why is it the size it is? So these are all things they're trying to figure out. So in other words, what dictates the formation, the processes that go alongside gravity that dictate the formation of a planet?
Right. Okay. And this is the first time that's ever been witness, we think, the first time we've ever seen a planet being born?
Absolutely. So we do know of a few thousand exoplanets. That's planets that are outside of our solar system. But we've never observed anything in a solar system that's at this exact stage. And the reason is it's very hard to take pictures of dust.
Right. And is this something that has already happened a long time ago? Are we seeing images of something very much in the past? Is it possible that is now a planet?
Well, it's 520 light years away, so that means it isn't that long ago. So it took 520 years for the light to get from the source to the telescope. So it's in space terms, that's a blink of an eye.
So how long does it take to make a planet, is what I'm saying?
Oh, well, that's another thing they'll have to find out, right? So they'll have to go looking for other solar systems that are at different stages of this process and see how long it does take to form a planet. But I imagine it's a gradual process.
Okay, very good. That's a good gut guess, I suppose. Susan, good to have you back. Our second story has to do with pain and an off switch in the brain.
That's right. Listeners to this show will often hear about different prodding and poking of the brain and different things that can happen as a result.
It's one of our favourite things.
It is, and it's not surprising either. But there are researchers in Duke University who have now found, as you said, a part of the brain that can turn off pain. Now, this is in mice, of course. A lot of studies start in mice, as we know. But it's in an area called the amygdala, and it's associated with fear. And it's the part of the brain that kicks into action, say, when you do a bungee jump or something terrifying. And in fact, in people who are reported to seem maybe fearless, they tend to have an atypical amygdala area. But what's new here is that most previous work has focused on regions of the brain that are turned on by pain. So when someone's in pain, we can see these areas light up. And the idea they thought was that you'd have to switch all of these areas off in order to then stop pain, which is a big undertaking. However, this work has found essentially the mother switch that connects all those areas, which is really fascinating. Of course, the little mice had to go through some pain in order to undergo this study, which is sad. They were given medication to cause them what was a low dose of pain. And then what happens in mice when they're given that is they start to self-soothe, essentially. They start licking their tiny little mouse paws, and they start scratching their little faces. And when the amygdala is then activated, this instantaneously stops. So they stop self-soothing and they feel fine again. But the researchers were able to create essentially a roadmap of pain, mapping out around 16 different routes in the brain that lit up when pain occurred. And then this amygdala essentially is like the hub, like the bus terminus right in the center, that when it's activated, it stops the pain going out throughout the brain. And one thing the researchers are really interested in is, and we hear this a lot, but I suppose this is something that is at least maybe targeting one area. Basically, they're looking to maybe specifically make a drug that can be delivered to that part of the brain that'll be able to stimulate it and therefore be able to reduce pain. Of course, we know that pain is very complicated and there's a lot of factors involved in pain, but it does seem to be at least a target where there's one thing to target rather than trying to solve problems all across the brain. So,
which is great, because obviously some people live with chronic pain, some people live with pain due to phantom limb, you know, things that we can't fix with mechanical repair. And the idea of being able to mute that pain somehow selectively would be very exciting indeed. This is the first time they've discovered that there's this sort of master switch for pain. Is that right?
Yes. I think the lady who ran the study in Duke University, she ultimately, her technique and her novel approach is the mapping. So no one was really able to do this mapping in the way that she's able to do it. So her sort of pioneering work has led to this result being discovered. So it's a really strong and impressive piece of work, I have to say.
Shane, our third story has to do with something that I had never really considered, and that is the direction of wind turbines and their effect on efficiency.
Yeah, I had heard years ago that, I think it was just one of those jokes, that Irish wind turbines went the other direction to all the other ones in the world. I think it was me believing it. And it's a quirk of the way they were made that almost all wind turbines in the world, 96% of them, turn clockwise. I guess it's just an engineer or two sat down and made a prototype, and they've been working off that idea since. So some German scientists in the German Aerospace Center have modeled this. They've wondered, what happens if you have a field of these wind turbines? Does the fact that they're all rotating the same direction matter in terms of the power output? And so they did a computer model of this setup. Now, this is really hard when you're doing anything to do with this sort of complex airflow. It's really,
turbulence
really hard.
Turbulence is a very tricky subject, yeah.
Absolutely. So it's incredible they were able to do it, and shows the power of computation at the moment. Unsurprisingly, if you have a field of turbines, the very first one that the wind hits has no effect, whether it's going clockwise or anti-clockwise. But the ones behind it there can be an effect. During the day, it's zero. So that whether they're going all going at the same direction or they're mixed, it doesn't matter, right? But at night, that changes. And this is where it's interesting. Yeah, this really bamboozled me. So at night, the way that the air is set up over the ground is different to during the day. So during the day, the sun heats the earth. The earth then causes a kind of vortices of warm air to rise above it and basically mixes the atmosphere that's just above the surface. So you have this very well mixed region of air. And so your wind turbine, whether it's going clockwise, anti-clockwise in that, nothing is going to matter there. But at night, the earth is cooler. And so the air that's close to the earth becomes quite still and you get this stratification. So you get these sort of like milky layers of air.
Laminar flow, I believe it's called.
Actually, yeah, I think you might be onto something there. And the fact that our wind turbines now are so big, you get these blades that are slicing through different sort of layer of air. That's very hard to say. They're so big, in fact, that you start to see something called the Coriolis effect, which is due to the rotation of the earth. And so in the northern hemisphere, the fact you're going to have this difference in air densities or the way they flow over each other, that's going to have this rotating effect. And so it's going to have a kind of a right-handed push on the wind.
Yeah.
And so in simple terms, what that means is that the wind direction can be slightly different at the bottom of the turbine to the top of the turbine, and that causes drag. And so it makes the wind turbine 23% less efficient than during the day. So the way to counter this is to have them all spinning in random directions, clockwise and anti-clockwise. I love this sort of story. It's just, you know, something you'd be looking at it and going, I wonder what would happen if. Yeah. And then you obviously can't build a field of turbines and test this. Well, you can't do it cheaply. So they go and do it on a computer. I think it's fantastic science.
Brilliant. Our final story, Susan, has to do with bees.
Yes, I think we can all agree that bees are great. I'm a big fan of them and what they do
for us. They're not listening, Susan. We don't have a big bee audience on the program. You can say what you want about bees.
Well, I stand by that, regardless of whether or not I've won their favor. But this is a remarkable article where bees have been discovered to bite plants to force them to flower sooner.
What?
Yeah, stick with me, because people, this is remarkable. It's really, the other nice thing, it's a nice story of scientific serendipity, where researchers in ETH Zurich were studying how bees responded to odors, and they happened to notice these tiny little half moon shaped holes in the leaves. And they noticed that the bees were cutting out these tiny little holes in the leaves. And there were bees from colonies with less food that were doing this. And also then knowing that some plants tend to up their flowering when they're under stress, they put two and two together and they wondered, could the bees possibly be doing this on purpose in order to get more food faster? And the work, which is published in Science this week, basically they set up sort of cages, big cages now, we're in lots of space for bees to fly, where they could study, they studied two different species and they studied two different plants, and they watched how the bees interacted with these plants. And they did some great control experiments that support the conclusion, which I really like, especially, I mean, it's in Science as well, which we know is an outstanding journal in terms of quality. So they basically saw that hungry bees make 5 to 10 holes in a plant, and then that plant takes 17 days to flower. Undamaged plants take 33 days to flower. Wow. So 50% faster flowering when the holes were cut in it. The second thing they noticed is that hungry bees cut 4 times more holes than bees that are full. So they had two different, again, species of bees and set up here. So they were up to study that. As the plants grew, so as spring continued, the bees made fewer holes in them, mainly because they didn't need them anymore because the flowers were on their way. My favorite bit of this is that the researchers themselves went in and cut tiny holes to see whether it was just tiny holes being cut made a difference. And they did flower earlier, but not as soon as the ones where the bees made the holes in it. So they think that it could be something in the saliva of the bee that's stimulating the growth of these flowers. And there, it's just, I think one thing that's, I noticed a quote from someone was saying, how didn't we notice this sooner? Like, how did we not notice these tiny holes in leaves? I for one, when the wind dies down, will go outside and have a little look. But it's a remarkable thing that obviously bees are starting to adapt to their environment to enable themselves to survive.
I love that story. And the thing that really sticks out at me is, unless you were really like looking at bees for a while, you just wouldn't see or spot that there is a tenacity that is associated with the single-minded approach of science, that if you look at something and study something for long enough, that something will just pop out of it.
It was World Bee Day this week.
Was it? What does World Bee Day mean, Shane? Apart from more propaganda for the bees.
For me, it means following lots of cool ecologists on Twitter. There's a remarkable number of Irish scientists who work on bees, like Dara Stanley in UCD.
This is all part of the mass marketing campaign. Does Dara have a Twitter handle?
She does. You just stick her name, Dara Stanley, into Twitter. You'll find her and many others like Jane Stout and Trinity who work on bees.
Excellent. Well,
and Blonin DCU needs a shout out too. I think there's a good bee department, I have to say.
Going on in this program?
God. It's the bee team.
They've gotten to you as well. All right. Dr. Shane Bergen and Susan Kelleher from UCD, thanks very much for joining us. Now, we have a very special episode coming up next week in which we'll be answering your sometimes ingenious, more often than not very bizarre questions. And we've had a huge response to our call for those. Too big, to be honest. And the fact of the matter is we couldn't fit all of the questions into next week's show. But one of the questions we couldn't fit in was one of my favorites. And there was just too much in it to only spend a few minutes on it. So we've decided to do a full feature on it this week. And so we have Professor of Biology from Georgetown University, Martha Weiss, on the line. And Martha, our question for you is, does a butterfly remember anything from when it was what seems to be a completely different creature, a caterpillar?
Well, the answer to that question is yes, it does. And the fact is, and the important thing to think about is that it wasn't really a completely different creature. It was another form of the same creature. And although it's hard to think about because they look so different, a caterpillar, of course, turns into a butterfly and they're the same animal. So if our caterpillar was named Jonathan and it was crawling around on a leaf, and then it went into a chrysalis, the chrysalis would be named Jonathan. And then when the butterfly emerged, the butterfly would be named Jonathan. They're all the exact same individual. And there are very profound physiological changes that happen to turn the caterpillar into the butterfly. And a lot of things dissolve and are remade, but there are also a bunch of things that persist.
So you've hit on something that is so amazing about this process of metamorphosis. And that is that I thought a caterpillar went into the cocoon, grew thinner and grew wings, and then came out. But that's completely wrong. It doesn't grow wings at all.
It's not completely wrong. What happens is that the caterpillar turns into a chrysalis, and basically what happens is that it sheds its last caterpillar skin, and then the tissue, the body of the caterpillar, is remodeled, and the butterfly is made out of the parts of the caterpillar. But we don't turn everything to goo. I think in fourth grade, we had this idea that the caterpillar sort of goes into the phone booth, turns into goop, and then Superman comes out and was rebuilt out of the goop. But what really happens is that the caterpillar goes into the chrysalis and part of the caterpillar is broken down. So a lot of the proteins that make up the body of the caterpillar are dissolved, but there are other structures and instructions that are retained, and then the caterpillar is remodeled into a butterfly. So obviously the caterpillar didn't have wings, it didn't have long spindly legs, it didn't have big compound eyes, it didn't have antennae to speak of, and all of those things are built from the stuff that the caterpillar was made out of. But here's the interesting thing. Well, there's a lot of interesting things. But one interesting thing is that there were cells that turn into all of those adult structures that were present the moment that the caterpillar, the tiny baby caterpillar, hatched out of an egg when it was the size of a grain of rice. And those little structures are called imaginal discs. And as the after the caterpillar gets big, the imaginal discs start developing and turn into the wings and the antennae and the legs. And that process happens inside the chrysalis. So as I said, we don't turn the caterpillar all the way to goo. There is stuff, a scaffolding that persists in the caterpillar that the butterfly is rebuilt or remodeled around.
Like a tube, or is it that central body? Or what when you say it's preserved, what's preserved?
So there are a few things that we know are preserved, and this we know this recently because there's some very cool new technology that allows us to look inside a chrysalis as the changes are taking place. And we can see that, for one thing, the tracheal tubes, which are basically the air tubes that go from the outside of the caterpillar into its tissues, and they look sort of like highways on a road map, those tubes persist because the tissue still has to breathe, and they're reorganized a little bit, but they persist. The gut is remodeled. The gut of the caterpillar changes shape. It gets narrower and shorter to become the butterfly's gut, but it persists. These imaginal discs persist, and they grow into their adult structures. And interestingly, and what gets to your original question, is that some of the nervous system persists. And my colleague, Doug Blackiston, and I did a series of experiments some years ago to look at the exact question that you were asking about. Can a caterpillar learn something that the moth or the butterfly will still remember?
How on earth do you test something like that?
Well, so it was actually a little bit hard to figure out how to design an experiment that would allow us to test it definitively, because if we fed the caterpillar something and then the butterfly or moth emerged and still responded to that smell, excuse me, we might say, oh, look, it remembered the smell. But you could make the argument that part of the reason they're remembering the smell is because maybe there was some residue left in its body and its digestive system or something like that. So we needed to use a cue that would be recognizable to the adult, but that wouldn't be carried over, so that if we wanted to really make sure that there was some memory rather than just having, you know, a little bit of goop on your shoe that you still smelled when you emerged, we had to design an experiment that didn't use food or something like that that could persist.
So you Pavlov trained a caterpillar?
So yes, the first thing we did was we took caterpillars and we used the tobacco hornworm, which is a caterpillar that turns into a big moth that you might have seen on your tomatoes or in your garden. They're a big caterpillar that does a lot of feeding damage on plants that we care about. But in any event, we took these caterpillars and we gave them a mild electric shock, which doesn't sound too nice, and they didn't like it, but they recovered from it. We gave them a mild electric shock in association with a volatile odor. So we exposed them to an odor that comes from plants. We gave them a shock while they were experiencing the odor. And we did that 8 times over the course of a day, once an hour. And then we took those caterpillars and we put them into an apparatus called a Y-tube maze, which is just what it sounds like, a three-dimensional maze in the shape of a Y. And we put the caterpillars in the long end of the Y, and in one of the arms, fresh air was pulled up through it, and in the other arm, that smell, that odious smell that they had associated with the electric shock was present. And so the caterpillars that had been trained to the shock, not surprisingly, turned in the direction of the fresh air to avoid the shock.
Yeah.
Caterpillars that had not been exposed to the shock or had been exposed just to shock but with no odor went 50-50 in either direction. So they didn't care. When we controlled the experiment very well so that we were quite confident that the result that we were seeing in the caterpillar was a result of this aversive conditioning. So first step one is we found that we could train caterpillars to avoid the odor. Then we let them pupate and they are in their chrysalis for four or five weeks. So 28 to 35 days, they're hiding out in a paper bag in the corner of the lab. And then the moths emerged and these big, beautiful moths come out. And then we ask the moths the same question. We put them in the wide tube with the same smells. And we said, you want to go to the clean air or do you want to go to the odor? And we were flabbergasted to see that the moths that had learned to avoid the odor as a caterpillar also avoided it as a moth. The moths that had not been exposed as caterpillars didn't care. They did 50-50. So it was clear, and it's important to note that this odor was ephemeral. They were exposed to the odor for short periods of time, probably, let's see, we did it 8 times 10 seconds each. So for less than 2 minutes, 6 weeks before, there was no residue of the odor on the chrysalis. We did other controls where we washed the chrysalis to make sure that there wasn't any odor on them, or we put odor on the outside of other chrysalids to see if we could introduce an odor later. And we got no results from any of those controls that would suggest that it was something external. So the ones that emerged having had the training as larvae recalled that association, the negative association between the odor and the shock, even 5 weeks later when they were adult moths, which Wow. is pretty cool, right?
Yeah, very cool. And so what does that tell us about this metamorphosis?
Well, let's see. It tells us a few things. One of them is that there is probably some neuronal connection. So some neurons are formed that encode memories in the caterpillar that are not entirely broken down in the chrysalis and that persist in the adult. Having said that, I have to tell you that we're not entirely sure what the mechanism is for this retention of memory. And there are a variety of different hypotheses that we have not investigated, so we don't know. But it seems plausible that there are some neuronal connections that persist and carry the memory across metamorphosis.
But I mean, obviously the first thought would be it's the brain, right? But is the brain not preserved, or do caterpillars not have brains in the same way we think of them?
They do have brains. Their brains are not as big or sophisticated as our brains, but they're certainly big enough and sophisticated enough to do all the jobs that the caterpillar and the butterfly need to have done. We don't know the fates of all of the neurons in the caterpillar, because that has, in this particular species of caterpillar, because it hasn't been investigated. But people have studied fruit flies and have looked at the fates of all of the neurons. And there's a particular part of the brain called the mushroom bodies in insects. And they're called mushroom bodies because they're kind of the shape of mushrooms. And the mushroom bodies encode the olfactory information that come from the antennae. And so we know what happens to the mushroom bodies in a lot of detail in Drosophila. And there's three different lobes of the mushroom bodies in Drosophila, one of them an early, one of them a middle, and one of them a late lobe. And the middle lobe, the early lobe is pruned back. So the synapses that have formed in the early lobe are pruned away in Drosophila before the fruit fly pupates. But the middle lobe forms later in the fly larva's life, and that lobe persists into the adult fly.
Okay.
The third lobe in the fly forms after the fly has pupated. So our candidate lobe, if Manduca, our caterpillar, operates in the same way as Drosophila, is that this memory could be encoded in that middle lobe, and it could persist across metamorphosis into the adult. So that our results are consistent with, although they don't prove that hypothesis.
Why does the caterpillar go through all of this to become the butterfly? Metamorphosis seems like such a energy intensive and risky endeavor for a creature.
That's a great question. And it's a question that pertains not just to caterpillars and butterflies, but for really the vast majority of insects on the planet. And we tend to think of caterpillars and butterflies as the insect exemplar of metamorphosis. But in fact, all of the most successful insect groups on the planet undergo what this whole process, which is called complete metamorphosis. And they start out as either a larva for a butterfly, or a maggot for a fly, or a grub for a beetle. And then they go into some sort of transitional phase, and then they emerge as a winged, sexually mature adult. So the reason that they do this is because we'll go back to the caterpillar and the butterfly as an example. They're specialized for different jobs. And the caterpillar's job is to eat, and to grow and get fat. And
that's
Read that book. Love that book. So our hungry caterpillar eats and eats and eats, and it molts and it gets bigger and bigger. Caterpillars are not sexually they're not sexually mature. They don't have wings, so they crawl around and they eat leaves. The butterfly's job is to reproduce and then disperse and deposit the eggs somewhere else so that they can be spreading out in the habitat. So part of the reason that this system works so well is because each of the different organisms is specialized for its particular function, and they don't have to compromise in terms of the structures or the behaviors that they have that allow them to do each of those functions, right? So if we needed to have something that was a good eating machine and could really focus on just chewing up those leaves, but it also had to travel long distances and have flashy colors and reproduce, it would have to compromise. But with these complete metamorphic insects, we can have larvae that are specialized for living in or on their food and eating, and they don't have to think about a lot of other stuff. And then we can have adults that can be specialized for attracting mates, mating, dispersing, and laying eggs. And so they have totally different jobs, and this division of labor is what makes them so successful. So this lifestyle, this holometabolous or complete metamorphosis lifestyle, evolved around 280 million years ago. And the insects that came from that lineage are not only the most successful insects on the planet, they're the most speciose and successful animals on the planet. So of all of the animals, most of them are holometabolous insects. And they're moths and butterflies, they're ants and bees and wasps and beetles and flies and fleas. Everybody you can think of is really doing this lifestyle.
When you look at this through the lens of evolution, survival of the fittest, or the selfish gene and so on, it seems so complicated. It seems to me complicated. That middle step seems, how would that survive through evolution? But I suppose back 300 million years ago, that process was probably a little bit more simplified and became more complicated through evolution, because I can see how a bird's beak can get longer if the food is deeper down in the sand. But how a creature could evolve to go from a caterpillar to something for a while and then into a butterfly just through environmental pressures. That's, for me, I find that more difficult to kind of get my head around how that would work.
Well, I think the proof is in the pudding. I mean, they're the most successful animals on the planet, and so it clearly works. And I think the trick or the key is in the division of labor and the fact that they do better as a specialized, all of these different groups of organisms do better with specialized larvae that have the hardware and the software, the jaws and the behaviors to eat a lot of whatever food they're in, whether it's a leaf for a caterpillar or a dead cow for a flesh fly or whatever it is, and then have winged dispersing forms as the adult, even with the cost of this risky transition. And the transition phase, the pupa or the chrysalis or whatever it is indeed dangerous because they can't really move and they can't really defend themselves. And so they need to go hide out somewhere and undergo this big transition. And it might take a couple days or it might take much longer. And they're vulnerable in that phase, but it still seems to be worthwhile because everybody's doing it.
Exactly. Martha, that was fantastic. Professor Martha Weiss from Georgetown University, thanks very much. And now it's time to look at some of our texts and tweets, and Aidan McKelvey, producer of the program, joins me on the line. Did I catch you working out again? You're so
No,
buff.
I'm not. Yeah, no, I'm You're not so working ripped. Out. I'm still in my dressing gown. So you got me at a better time of the day, actually.
It's 1:20 in the afternoon. What are you doing in your dressing gown? Have you gone full Big Lebowski?
Pretty much. Well, my lockdown regime is Big Lebowski for the first half of the day. And the only thing that gets me out of the dressing gown is the workout later on. And we haven't quite gotten there yet.
That's kind of quite a squanchy lifestyle you have for yourself.
They're very squanchy. Nice
How's
use
it going?
Of the word squanchy as well.
There you go. Right, and let's go through some of our texts and tweets from last week. And we were talking about COVID, which, you know, the first few weeks it was, as is the news cycle, you know, I talk about the media, the news, and how things work. Typically, it follows this exact pattern of, you know, first it's information, then it's, you know, a couple of days later, it's, you know, what you need to do. And then after that, it's finger pointing. And then, you know, after a while, people get up the guts to start throwing around conspiracy theory. And of course, the first few weeks of this COVID, people wanted to know what's going on, what can we do? They wanted information. And now we seem to get nothing but, you know, conspiracy theories and wild accusations and unfounded claims and people saying it's all a conspiracy. It was all invented by Bill Gates or the bees did it. It seems just as predictable as life itself. So we got an email in, a text in from someone who says, can you please have Dr. Dolores Cahill on your program? There is no need for a vaccine. You know, as a broadcaster, it's tricky to weigh up these things and figure out what you need to do. The good news is I'm not talking typically about the news. I'm talking about the science. I'm not a news broadcaster, so I don't have to weigh these things up. But giving someone a voice, and I'm very clearly and emphatically not saying this is Dr. Dolores Cahill. I don't know her views. I've tried to watch a YouTube video of hers, but it was taken down because of YouTube's guidelines. The people retweeting Dr. Dolores Cahill are people who espouse opinions that I do not agree and are very anti-science. However, I don't know Dr. Dolores Cahill herself. I do know she's an academic. But the point is, just because someone says something against the grain doesn't necessarily mean that giving that person a voice is providing a fair representation of the balance. And I'm reminded of the argument. Who was it? was it Trevor Noah or it was one of those talk show hosts wanted to, I think it was John Oliver, wanted to provide, you know, climate change balance. And so they had a climate change denier in studio, and then they had 100 climate scientists in studio to sort of counterbalance. It was over egging a point made, but giving one person a platform that fully disagrees with general consensus worldwide regarding the science of this. Again, I have not heard Dr. Kyle's views, but I do know they go against some of what the government is calling for. It's a tricky thing to do, but the good news is that I'm not really interested in that sort of item anyway, so I don't have to make that difficult decision. So we won't be having Dr. Dolores Kyle on the program. Another says, hi guys, you're going to discuss alternative cures for COVID-19. There are plenty of doctors who have been talking of different treatments that seem to help, but are been silenced. Well, if you've heard from them, they clearly haven't been silenced. There's a quote from Dara O'Brien that he did in his comedy skit talking about alternative medicine. Medicine that works, we call medicine. The stuff that's alternative doesn't get to be called medicine. And there's good legal and medical reasons for that. I think you need to prove that your stuff works. And when you prove it stuff works, you get to stick the medicine sticker on your bottle. And I think that's the best way to do it. So alternative cures and alternative treatments. We've done a program on the harm that some of these things can cause, the confusion and the trouble that goes with promoting something that may have a small effect in some area, but it hasn't been properly tested, and then giving that a huge platform, much like President Trump has done with his recent talk about how he's been taking unapproved, unproven treatment for preventing COVID. So I'm not going to discuss alternative cures on a science program, no. And I think actually we still don't know a lot. What we're talking about is the science of COVID-19, where there is any actual science, of which, you know, actually tested and proven there isn't a huge amount at the moment. And this is, hi, Jonathan, have been listening for many years to the program. Love the format, the up-to-date science, mixed with the perfect blend of witty comments and sarcastic tones. That's what we're aiming for. I've been wondering, since this social distancing began, if there's been any research or if there's been any looking into the effects of worldwide lockdown and social distancing on other viruses and infectious diseases. Now, that is very interesting. Surely with many people distancing or isolating, people being more careful and so on, some infectious diseases that have short dormancy periods and that require frequent person-to-person contact to live could become extinct. That's not something I've heard of, but yeah, of course. So any transmissible disease, including STIs, I imagine, the STIs, I would imagine, they are plummeting because people are just not getting the action they're used to getting. I think certainly we would definitely see a drop in STIs, Aidan. Another transmissible. This could be a boon. There might be things in years to come. We go, hey, what happened to that virus? And actually, the social distancing killed it.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting. I imagine we couldn't really do a piece on it now because everybody's science, essentially everyone's projects are focused on COVID-19, so I don't know who if anyone would actually be looking into this at the moment.
Yeah, that's from
but it's got to have a massive
great
impact.
Idea. I hadn't heard someone float that. That's the emails we got on COVID. Then we got a load of emails in from you asking questions for Faster Proof, which we're going to be answering some of them next week, but we got so many that it's just impossible to answer them all. So it looks like we might end up doing another Faster Proof in the not too distant future to get them, because we've got some brilliant questions from you. But we talked about Planet Nine last week, and this is this unknown distant object that's orbiting the sun in a really wide path that we haven't yet found, but we suspect is there. And we spoke to Mike Brown about it. One person says, do you realize you're talking about Planet X as if it was new? This is the most discussed planet ever, with huge implications for Earth. I'm surprised at you. Another says, this isn't a new find. The ancient Sumerians wrote about this planet 5,000 years ago. So, look, there's a bit of a game. Aidan knows this. There's a bit of a game that a presenter plays, and it's called taking the position of the listener. I, as it happens, and I'm sort of I'm showing the fourth wall here, Aidan, but I know everything. And I have to pretend I don't know everything so that people aren't in some way cowed or intimidated by my knowledge and don't listen to the program. So I have to pretend not to know these things all the time. And so I act surprised.
It's great for me as well, like that you know everything, because it means that I don't really have to do any work. I just press the record button and Jonathan comes on and
are
just...
Are you talking about the research you give me?
Yeah, I don't need to do any research. He just comes on and he knows what we're talking about.
But did you know, the funny thing is that people listen to the program, right? And then they say, God, you know, you really know your stuff. And I just kind of like, I keep a cool, straight face on the outside. On the inside, I'm pissing myself laughing because I literally remember none of this stuff. I mean, I really remember none of it, which is an awful shame because honestly, I would know everything after 10 years of doing this program, but I retain so little of it that if I didn't have to go and revisit and read the research you guys do and have a look at online stuff before I do these interviews, I'd be like, and what's a planet again?
In fairness, there's probably an interesting feature in your brain, Jonathan, because I think like it's all in there, but there's some sort of issue with the accessing of it. Because every so often you'll come out with something like, wow, that's amazing. How do you know that? I don't know. I don't know how I know that, but it's in there somewhere.
I think there's a sort of Indiana Jonesian labyrinth that my brain has to go to access the information it needs to do. And only every once in a while does it come out unscathed with a bejeweled skull in its hand. On vaccinating vampire bats, we were talking about this idea of like transmissible vaccine, which I think is a way out idea, but hey, look outside the window. Peter O'Connor says, leave the bats in peace and let them do best what they do best, eating bugs and pollinating. Well, from that interview, Peter, we learned they also like give people rabies and suck people's blood at night through their windows. So, you know, I mean, there's leaving them in peace and then there's, you know, they're not a fully innocent party, I would say. And to finish off, we were talking about siphonophores, this extraordinary spiral sort of, it's a jellyfish type thing, but it's like, it's in a spiral. It's the longest animal in the world. And Kevin says, Shane's story about the giant jellyfish is further evidence to me that we should be investigating our oceans more before they even think about going to the moon again or Mars. We know so little. Absolutely. I mean, they always talk about our oceans being the true undiscovered and accessible area of our universe that we should be exploring further.
Yeah, even in that story, they were saying, like, as the sort of prelude to the siphonophores bit, the scientists in question had gone down and they discovered something like 17 new species, and it was only on the way back up when they were having their cup of tea that they saw this thing.
Yeah,
and that's in one trip. It's amazing. Like,
I know it does make you want. It makes me want to go out and dive again. I miss that so much, and I'm planning to go on a trip in November. I just hope it works out where I get to go under the water again somewhere that is alive, unlike Dunleary Bay, which is just dead, or extremely cold. Like, fair dues to those divers, I have to say. Right, and finally, as we mentioned, we were looking for your emails and questions for a special edition of the program called Faster Proof, and we got loads of brilliant questions that we hadn't ever considered, and so we can't fit them all in, and we're going to get to many of them in another episode of Faster Proof. So listen out for next week. You'll get the idea and send us your questions. And maybe it's something we do every couple of months, because some really interesting sort of head melters came from you asking questions that I hadn't ever considered. So thank you so much for all of those. But a special mention has to go to this letter that we received, because it was handwritten. It's from Teresa Kenny. And we don't get many handwritten letters that aren't accusations of being, you know, part of Satan's plot or some other nonsense from someone who has an issue with science. But this is from Teresa Kenny, and she wrote to us saying, Dear Jonathan, I listen to News Talk, but my favorite program is your science one. Since the 12th of March, I'm child free. I'm a nana of 68 to 3 grandchildren. My brain is working 10 to a dozen and thinking about humankind. And a child would ask, Why is grass called grass? And why was it not blue? And why is a house called a house? I couldn't answer the question for them. And for me, all the colours of the rainbow, how do they come up with that? Because when a child is born and learning to walk and talk, we coo and talk with rhymes. So from a young age, we know how to teach children. It's a long-winded question, but when did we learn to use our speech? She goes on to say, Jonathan, my favourite subject was locked-in syndrome. Thank you for giving me the gift of learning science. Yours sincerely, Teresa Kenny. And you know, that is just such a wonderful letter to receive from someone. We appreciate all the emails and texts that we get from people, but to have a handwritten letter from a 68-year-old Nana from Artane talking to us about how the program has given her the gift of learning science is just wonderful. It's just one of those things that you don't get them very often, but it makes you feel $1 million, as they say. So Teresa, thank you so much for those letter. I'll be writing to you back, but I just wanted to acknowledge it for everyone else. Thank you so much. That is the end of this week's podcast. You'll find more in the feed on Tuesday and Thursday. Aidan McKelvey was producing. Simon Keane was researching and on sound. Jojo Cardozo will be back next Saturday with more new Future Proof on News Talk 12 p.m. In the meantime, stay curious.